From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The identity of the perpetrator of Saturday's deadly bomb attack during a peaceful anti-war protest in Turkey's capital remained unknown as of Monday. The massive rally was called to protest the Turkish government's involvement in Syria. The rally was rocked by two explosions. More than 90 people were reportedly killed in the incident in the capital, Ankara. Press TV's Kanish Fatima has more.
Turkey says two male suicide bombers have carried out Saturday's deadly twin bombings in the capital, Ankara, which killed scores of people. The Office of Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu said efforts are underway to identify the corpses of the slain assailants. The Turkish government says 97 people were killed in the attacks. It says 92 bodies have so far been identified. This is while the People's Democratic Party says 128 people lost their lives in the explosions. No group has claimed responsibility for the attacks.
The attack was condemned by the UN Secretary General, as DN Penn reports.
The UN Secretary General expects the perpetrators of the terrorist bombings to be swiftly brought to justice, according to a statement issued by his spokesperson. At least 86 people reportedly died and more than 180 were injured when two bombs exploded during a peace rally in the Turkish capital on Saturday morning. No one has immediately claimed responsibility. Ban Ki-moon sent his heartfelt condolences to the families of the victims and to the people and government of Turkey. He also wished a speedy recovery to those wounded in the attack. Deanne Penn, United Nations.
Meanwhile, early reports that Iraqi airstrikes, guided by Russian targeting data, may have killed ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi have yet to be confirmed, and the death of the ISIS leader has been denied by the group. The Iraqi military issued a statement saying, quote, Iraqi air forces have bombed the convoy of the terrorist Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi while he was heading to Karabla to attend a meeting with Daesh commanders, closed quote. Although al-Baghdadi is reportedly one of the U.S.'s most wanted terror targets, he's apparently been able to lead caravans of his forces across hundreds of miles of desert for more than a year without facing serious air fire from either U.S. forces or the Iraqis, who rely on U.S. targeting information. The attack came in the second week of Russian involvement in the air campaign against the terrorist group. Iraq's military command said that aside from the attack on al-Baghdadi's caravan, the location of the planned ISIS meeting was also bombed, and that, quote, many of the group's leaders were killed or wounded, closed quote. It described al-Baghdadi's condition as unknown, adding that he was, quote, carried away by a vehicle. His health condition is still unclear, closed quote. Hospital officials and local residents later told Reuters that at least eight unidentified senior figures from ISIS were killed in the airstrikes on the meeting, which struck two houses in the Anbar province of Iraq. At least two dozen people were killed in the latest Saudi airstrikes on Yemen. Four people were killed in the northern Sa'ada province. Another five died in Sana'a province. 15 were also killed in airstrikes on a prison in Baida province in the south. Saudi Arabia has been bombing Yemen for more than 6 months. Nearly 6,500 Yemenis have been killed, with women and children constituting most of the casualties. In response to the airstrikes, Yemeni fighters have stepped up attacks against Saudi positions both at the border and inside Saudi Arabia. The latest retaliatory attacks hit a military base in Jizan, where casualties were reported among Saudi soldiers. Hussein al-Hukadi is an activist and political commentator in Sana'a, and he filed this report early Monday.
In Saudi latest retaliation attack, they concentrate their attack on civilians area. At the beginning of this war against Yemen, they did bomb military bases and civilians area, but now we've seen most of their bombing, it could be in 80 to 90% on civilians area. We have seen in the last 2 weeks they bombed two wedding, killing about 200 and injuring many, and today they have targeted a mosque in Al-Khuba in Al-Hudaydah, and as well they have targeted a building block in Taiz, and there are reports of dozens of casualties.
Two suicide bombers blew themselves up in northern Cameroon Sunday morning, killing 11 people. A senior army source cited by Reuters said that there were 11 dead and 10 injured. The incident took place in the town of Mora, which is close to the Nigerian border and is a known stronghold of the terrorist group Boko Haram. At least 38 people, including 5 suicide bombers, were killed in a number of terrorist attacks in the border town of Bagassola in Chad, with 51 more people reportedly injured. 3 blasts were said to have hit in the town's market, and another struck a refugee camp. The attacks were suspected to have been committed by the Nigerian group Boko Haram, according to a local government official. This past Friday, we spoke with Tony Solo about the recently announced deal that has apparently been cut on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. We spoke about what it might mean for the Latin America and Caribbean region. We spoke with Tony via Skype Friday from Managua.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership, they call it, and as many commentators have noted, although it's being sold to the general public and to the population at large in the United States, and in particular as a trade deal, it is in fact a treaty very much in favor of big corporations, big transnational corporations. And the thing that's been holding it up, apparently it's been in the pipeline for 3-4 years now. The negotiations have been going on, and last week there was apparently some kind of breakthrough in the talks that had been held up largely by Japan's unwillingness to leave unprotected various parts of its industry and agriculture, and they seem to have overcome that by the United States making significant concessions on its part. And so, although they say that there's been this great breakthrough and the treaty is likely to be to come into effect in the foreseeable future, it's not at all clear that the legislation is going to pass through the respective parliaments and national assemblies and the respective legislatures of the member countries. I think you said it was 12 member countries.
Yeah, I think that's what they've been advertising, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm the big winners are the big pharmaceutical companies and other big corporations with quasi-monopoly control of global industries and global sectors like pharmaceuticals, like agrochemicals, for example. And Monsanto is going to be a huge beneficiary of the TPP.
Right.
It was from a point of view of Latin America and the region, it was interesting to see that 3 of the Pacific Alliance, the so-called Pacific Alliance countries, that's Mexico, Peru, Chile and Colombia, Mexico, Chile and Peru, were all part of the talks that led to this agreement. And so that's quite depressing from the point of view of Latin America. I know, but interesting that Colombia wasn't part of that agreement.
Yeah, and there's some interesting things going on in Colombia too. I saw that Dos Santos' attorney general is investigating a rebate for criminal violations of one kind or another. So there's some kind between that and the negotiations that are ongoing in Havana. There's some sort of ambivalence or some contradictions that are evidenced within the elites inside Colombia, and I wonder if that bears on this.
Well, it's difficult. I don't read the Colombian media every day. It's difficult to get a handle on that. What is very clear is that the United States has been playing, as usual, a key role in developments in Colombia. And the United States has supported Colombia's aggressive campaign against the FARC guerrilla, ever since the early 2000s, when it looked as though there might even be a peace agreement, when the FARC guerrilla at that point were in a far better position militarily than they are at the moment. But what people don't understand, a lot of people don't understand about Colombia, is that the FARC EP, the guerrilla, they control a lot of territory in Colombia, and they have a very, very strong social base, particularly in rural areas. And so, whereas the corporate media, the Western media, tend to project it as, oh well, the FARC guerrilla at the end of their resources, at the end of the line, they can't keep the war going, so they've had to capitulate. But that's not the case at all. It's very far from being the case, and you can see that from the way that the government has made very serious efforts to try and reach accommodations with the FARC guerrilla, in particular in the area of how to manage the legal aspect of the end of the conflict, because in some ways one could almost argue that they seem to be throwing to the wolves Santos's former colleague Alvaro Uribe, who was very closely identified with the narco-terrorist paramilitary sector in Colombia. And they were the tool that the United States and its allies, like Britain and Israel, who played a minor role, but not an insignificant role, in supporting the Colombian government through the first decade of this century in its vicious terrorist paramilitary campaign, to try and break the FARC guerrilla militarily, and they failed miserably. They completely failed, and that cost U.S. taxpayers many, many billions of dollars. And I've forgotten how much the total is, and I should imagine it's well over $10 billion for the period 2000 to the present. And that policy was a complete failure, and that looks to be the reason why the United States seems they seem to have accepted, in the same way that they've accepted that the blockade against Cuba is completely counterproductive, they seem to have accepted that it's in their interests, it's in the interests of the United States and its corporations to promote a peace process in Colombia, and that would explain why the United States seems to have thrown to the wolves their former protege Alvaro Uribe, because prior to the apparent imminent success of these peace talks, the United States had clearly backed the, what one might call the war party in Colombia, and that is led by Alvaro Uribe, and a key component of the military campaign against the FARC guerrilla have been the narco-terrorist paramilitaries. Now, why do I call them narco-terrorists? Because
they are.
It's the paramilitaries are the force in Colombia that has absolutely dominated the drugs trade. That, you know, periodically, and over the years, you get functionaries and officials of the US government claiming that the FARC are deeply involved in the drug trade. And well, that's not true in the sense that the FARC don't traffic drugs into the United States. And you can see that from the number of FARC members that have been extradited to the United States. I mean, I think two or three out of a total of dozens of people that have been extradited from Colombia to the United States are members of the FARC. And in the case of Simón Trinidad, the FARC commander, when the United States authorities tried to, the Attorney General tried to pin some drugs charges on Simón Trinidad, their case collapsed because they had no evidence. And the only evidence they had against another leading FARC member, known as Sonia, that was her nom de guerre, and that depended entirely on tainted testimony from an informer of the Colombian army. And so, you know, there's no solid evidence linking the FARC to trafficking of drugs out of Colombia into other countries, whereas on the other hand, there's very strong evidence. And in fact, the United States authorities have successfully prosecuted, and well over 20, I think, is the current figure, might be more,
right.
Right-wing paramilitary figures for precisely that offence of trafficking large quantities of drugs into the United States. And as you mentioned, I think you mentioned to me that the Colombian Attorney General is now bringing a case against Alvaro Uribe for a terrorist, a notorious terrorist attack. in the department of Antioquia, in the community of Aru, in 1997, where a paramilitary force, very much behaving like the Nicaraguan Contra used to do, they entered this village of Aru, burnt most of it to the ground, terrorized the population, murdered, I think it's a total of 15 of the people in the village. And Alvaro Uribe was governor of Antioquia at the time, and it was he that promoted that scorched earth policy of paramilitary terror.
Right.
And so, and that, you know, that's just one example out of hundreds, if not thousands, of incidents in Colombia where narco-terrorist paramilitaries, under the political control of Alvaro Uribe and Alvaro Uribe's elite cronies, were responsible for all those incidents. So now Juan Manuel Santos, who comes from a different section of the Colombian oligarchy, he comes from a much the kind of Colombian aristocracy, if you like, the landed aristocracy, whereas Alvaro Uribe is very much a nouveau riche, recently arrived upstart in terms of the Colombian oligarchy. So there's actually a class difference, if you like, between Juan Manuel Santos and Alvaro Uribe. And that, you know, you can see that now in the way that Juan Manuel Santos and his section of the Colombian oligarchy are essentially throwing Alvaro Uribe to the wolves and putting a lot of pressure on the paramilitary sector. Now, what they have to be careful about, and now you have to understand that this is just my very crude appreciation of the political and kind of class scene in Colombia. What Juan Manuel Santos and his circle have to be worried about is keeping the hostile military under control, because the military in Colombia are themselves an economic power, as they are in a country like Guatemala or Honduras, for example. And so Juan Manuel Santos is having to balance the kind of Alvaro Uribe narco-terror clique against reactionary officers in the Colombian military who are still living out their fantasies of the Cold War. And he's trying to project himself as, you know, the great factor for reconciliation, the great factor that will finally unite Colombia, finally end this extremely damaging civil war, in effect, that Colombia has been living for 60 years now. And you could trace it back right back to 1948 with the murder of Jorge Eliécer Gaitán, the great liberal reforming figure of the late 40s, who was murdered by, you know, in very suspicious circumstances. And so that, and Juan Manuel Santos is trying to kind of carve out a niche for himself in Colombia's history, if you like, as the person who ended that terrible civil war and brought Colombia into the 21st century, modernizing it and completely overhauling its society and turning its economy into a regional powerhouse. And that's how he wants to be seen.
And this may bear on the absence of Colombia from the list of signatories to the TPP, if that's how it plays out, the domestic political considerations. Because clearly the trend among Latin American countries, the vast majority of them, is against the neoliberal model that this treaty represents. What's interesting also is the Japanese government and their domestic political situation. You had almost simultaneously with the announcement of there being a deal, a purge of the Japanese cabinet. and an announcement by Prime Minister Abe that the focus of the cabinet now and of the changes that he was making would be economic. Well, Japan's been in a malaise for 20-some-odd years now economically, and that comes on the heels, of course, of a very unpopular move that he made, allowing the government much more leeway in military matters outside of the constitutional restraints of Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution. So he's turning around, reconfiguring the landscape politically for towards this treaty, or in conjunction with doing this treaty, and trying to save his own behind from the huge hit in popularity that he took because of the military deal. So the domestic political considerations seem to be, abounding among the signatories and the apparently non-signatories of that treaty.
Yeah, and it's difficult to know the perception of in a country like Colombia. And again, I'm just so distant from Colombia's internal goings on that it's difficult to get a handle at all on how the dominant clique, currently that of Juan Manuel Santos, may view the TPP. And if one looks at it take a couple of steps back from Latin America and looks at it from a global kind of perspective, and it is insane. And I think Abe is going to go down. He's probably going to lead his political faction into 10, 20, 30 years of political oblivion as a result of his policies. Because the TPP isn't going to lift Japan out of stagnation. The TPP isn't even going to lift the United States out of stagnation. That's not right. What it's for.
Right.
It's for goosing corporate profits. That's what the TPP is about. By subjugating national sovereignty to the interests of the tiny corporate elite that is trying to run the global economy. And that what that tiny corporate elite, a transatlantic elite, but also a trans-Pacific elite, as we've seen from the capitulation by Abe, and the capitulation by the Australian and New Zealand governments also, that tiny corporate elite is up against forces like the sovereign power of the Russian Federation, the sovereign power of China. In Latin America, it's up against a very determined defense of sovereignty by the government of Brazil under Dilma Rousseff and formerly under Ignacio Lula da Silva, under the Kirchners and their political grouping in Argentina. You know, these Argentina and Brazil are very strong economies, and they dominate Mercosur, of course, which now is has Venezuela as a member and will soon have Bolivia as a member. That means that the ALBA countries that have kind of been somewhat on the margins of global concerns are moving into the center of global concerns, because as members of Mercosur, they'll be influencing a major global economic bloc. And so you look at that and you see that the corporate elites are up against these very strong forces defending the national sovereignty that is the only defense of peoples against corporate depredation. And whereas in the United States and Japan, and the defense of their populations is being completely abandoned.
Yeah.
Now, what are these great alleged benefits of the TPP?
Well, before let me give you another example of what you were just saying, because we'll go back again to Japan. There was an interview on CCTV yesterday or the day before of a Chinese academic, Liu Baocheng, from the School of International Business and Economics in Beijing. And he pointed out that the trilateral talks that had been taking place between China, South Korea, and Japan were deliberately stalled by Abe. And he said, now seeing this announcement, it was clear that the reason was he was doing that at the bidding of the United States in order to prepare the way for this TPP, which, from the point of view of Japan, of course, the biggest growth engine they could possibly have would be unfettered access to the market in China. forgetting all the historical antagonisms and everything else, there's 1.5 billion people there. Many of them have discretionary income, and they would love to buy products that are produced in Japan. And rather than getting, you know, the most favored, you know, not using the term of art, but in fact, the most favored trading status that you could get under the treaty that was being negotiated, they decided to throw in with the United States and its multinationals.
Yeah, I'm very much against the interests of the Japanese people. And then, so then going back to the issue, you know, what are these great alleged benefits of the TPP? Well, I've tried to kind of get to some good economic analysis of, you know, what the TPP is likely to mean for the economies of the countries who sign up to it over the next 10, 15, 20 years, because that's the reasonable perspective to take. And if you take that perspective, I mean, all the arguments that I've seen, all the calculations that I've seen, suggest that the overall benefit to the GDP of the United States, for example, is likely to be an increase of something between 0.4% and 0.7% over the next decade. Mm. You know, but the costs to people in the United States are going to be much greater. Yeah. And in terms of, you know, their access to safe products, their environment, because the costs of the TPP, the environmental costs in particular, are going to be externalized onto the people of the countries concerned.
Right.
And so all those environmental and social costs that the TPP implies that don't get factored into GDP calculations are going to be borne by the populations of the signatory countries.
Right.
And the corporations are going to rake in the benefit, because the 0.4-0.7% range of an increase in GDP doesn't reflect the reality in corporate profits.
Right.
Which are going to be quite significant. I know it's very difficult to get a good economic appreciation of what the likely costs and benefits are going to be, because it's all so secretive.
Right.
And that's, but I'm, that figure is a figure that even the lobbyists, the 0.4-0.7% range of increase in GDP is the figure that even the apologists for the TPP accept, apparently.
Right.
So, you know, and it's...
That's essentially the price of sovereignty in terms of environmental regulation, labor rights regulation, all of the things that are being surrendered to these multinationals. In return, we get this maybe 0.5 point increase in GDP, which really probably represents some, you know, multiples of that in corporate profit, minus multiples of that in lost GDP to the rest of the economy here.
Yeah, no, and of course, the fundamental thing about the TPP, that the fundamental component, or the key component, if you like, perhaps fundamental isn't the right word, the key component, is this state, what is it, the International State Investor Dispute Mechanism,
right,
that transfers judicial oversight of that might defend the interests of the people of a given sovereign country. It transfers judicial oversight from the courts, from the national courts, to what is essentially a private tribunal system that is run overwhelmingly by lawyers from the private corporate sector, who are outrageously biased in favor of corporate interests. So it's just extraordinary that legislators in the countries concerned are allowing that provision to be incorporated, and not only allowing it to be incorporated, but in a way that they aren't even allowed to talk about.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.